Hello!
Hello!
My name's Asya.
And my name's Manvir.
And this is Audacious Aunties.
Gosh, that was so smooth.
I'm so proud of us. You know why? It only took us 5 seasons.
Yeah.
But we did it.
Yeah, well done to us. Can you believe that this is our 5th season?
I literally can't. I think what's weird is that when we started this podcast, we not to go on a trip down memory lane already, but we were like wee fresh first years.
Oh my god.
And now
No.
Like it was the summer between first and second year, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
And now both of us have graduated, our undergrads at least.
Yeah.
And
thank you for the reminder. I'm never leaving the institution.
And we're living our lives.
Yeah, it is freaky. I think especially as well, the way that we've spaced out our seasons too.
Mm.
Because we literally, I don't know what we were doing, but we finished season one and we went straight to season two.
Yeah.
And then I think we calmed down and like actually had a break
between
season two and season three.
Yes.
And then I think we took a longer break between season three and season four.
Yeah.
And I think this is the longest break that we've taken now between.
Yeah, absolutely. I think.
Oh, dang it. Wait, give me a hot sec.
Is it still recording? Okay. I feel like there's not an Audacious Aunties episode without a phone from one of your family when we are recording at your house.
I know, it's terrible. Oh. Well, you're always subject to my very bad Punjabi, so you're welcome.
I think, it, you know what, you're trying.
That's all that matters.
Yeah, but like, I feel like it's been such a constant throughout like the pandemic and throughout my university existence. Like it's just been such a journey.
Mm.
Like it's, I've changed so much as a person since we started this show.
Yeah.
And now look where we are.
It is really nice actually. I do like, even sometimes in the sounds of our voices from the first season, I feel like they've changed a little bit. And like just the way that we speak every now and then. Maybe I say like more, maybe I say less, like, I don't know. Back to this season and then this episode.
Yes.
What's this season about, Asya?
So this season is all about like folklore.
Oh, no.
I'm so unself-aware as a person. So this season is all about folklore, legend, tales, myths, stories from outside the Western world, obviously.
Amazing. So if you came here for the Grimm's Brothers. Brothers. Is it with an S?
I think it's just the Grimm Brothers.
Oh, the Mandela Grimms. Effect.
The brother, or it's like the Brothers Grimm.
Yes, okay. If you're here for stories from them, basically.
Yeah, now you're going to be impressed.
Yeah, so we're starting off this episode, this season, with you.
With me. And it's been a long time coming. I have been very indecisive about where I'm going to start this season with, because I feel like somehow I often get the first episode of the season.
Yeah, you do.
Which really sets the tone, you know.
And it's, and you always take the token South Asian one as well, and I'm like, yeah, now I have to do work.
Well, you'll be pleased to hear that we're actually mixing it up today bit, and we are going to be starting with perhaps one of the oldest texts we know, the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Oh my god.
For today's episode. So
how exciting. This is a good starting
episode.
Okay.
I will tell you how I was inspired to do it.
Please do.
So I was like, I do have a token South Asian one for later on this season. You'll all be excited to look forward to, but that requires a bit more research and I did not have the time. So and as a classicist, if anybody has forgotten at this point, I, you know, ancient stuff is my jam. So I've always known about the Epic of Gilgamesh, but never really had the chance to study it because our universities aren't decolonized. And so, but I knew it existed. And then
that's a start.
I know, right? And then last week I was like thinking about Audacious Aunties. I was like, gosh, I just don't know what to do. I don't have like the time to research like a big episode.
Mm.
And I was in Waterstones and I saw like a translation of the Epics of Gilgamesh on the table. And I was like, I can't believe I don't even have a translation in my like collection. So I bought it. And when I went to the till to buy it, the person was really excited that I was buying it and was like, oh my god, I love the Epic of Gilgamesh and let me recommend this in our time Time episode about it that you should listen before you read it. So I bought it and I listened to the In Our Time episode, which was very interesting.
Don't tell me that this is now going to be like a knockoff of the In Our Time
episode. It's not, mainly because I listened to the In Our Time episode when I was heavily sleep deprived, so I only remember like 5% of it. But I felt the vibes and that's what was important. So then I was like, this is it. This was meant to be. I need to do this as our first episode.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. Okay, give us a background to it all then.
So the Epic of Gilgamesh is a epic poem, essentially. And it's one of the oldest texts we have surviving from like the third, we believe it's based around like the third millennium BCE. Mm-hmm. And it's based in the area like of Mesopotamia, which more specifically southern Mesopotamia, that is such a difficult word to say, Mesopotamia.
Yeah,
southern Mesopotamia. which is known for like the Sumerian area of the region, and for modern day people who don't know where that is, it covers sort of the areas of Iraq, Kuwait, Turkey and Syria, like that area of the world. And yeah, so it's basically very cool and very old. And that's the vibes, that's amazing. The context. So it was founded originally, the text was in Nineveh, as on tablets, Akkadian language tablets. And that gave us the most of the story. And then throughout the years, throughout the centuries, we found the gaps in incomplete fragments and been able to slot them in. So it's a bit of a mishmash of things. Mm. But yeah, we've got a lot of it now. There's still a few gaps in the story, but yeah, we generally have a lot of it.
That's so cool. There must be like people, like authors who might have thought it was really cool to like fill in those gaps with their own ideas or stories, or just like throughout the passage of history, like the way that this like epic poem might have been orally transmitted, like I just, who knows, you know, like what different versions of this story might be.
That's true. And as you say, like obviously back in the day the main way that stories were passed on was orally. And yeah, there would have been loads of different versions of it that were slightly changed depending on the culture and the context and just memory. So yeah, gosh, there must be so many, who knows what version we have of the story and how it differs from the very original first take of the story.
Wild. Okay, what's the story about now? Come on, let's get to the juicy stuff.
Okay, so the story is super wild. It's a wild time. So basically, we obviously follow our main guy, Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
strong star. And he is, if I remember correctly, 2/3 divine from the gods, wow, and 1/3 human.
I love that. I don't want easy halves, I want thirds, you know.
Exactly.
Amazing. But that's weird. How are the thirds happening?
That's such a good question.
Do they explain it?
Well, I believe he's made, so they just kind of mishmash him up.
I love that. That's incredible. Because I was wondering, it's like maybe he's come from like 3 parents.
Well, he does have various parents, but one of the parents.
How was he conceived?
Let me find it. This is now where our Wikipedia comes in handy.
Okay. I feel like I'm asking 2 specific questions now, like how was he conceived rather than what is the story of Gilgamesh?
I will find it for you. Because so this is side context as well, which is like really hilarious. So basically, I was meant to bring the Epic of Gilgamesh with me this weekend to like read whilst I was like here before we recorded this episode.
Have you started reading it?
Well, I accidentally left the copy in London. And I was like, oh no, I like want to hear at least a bit of it before I record this episode.
Yeah.
So I went on Spotify to see if like anybody had recorded an audiobook. Cool. And somebody had, and I was like, okay, perfect. So I started listening to it. But then like, I don't know, whilst I was listening, I was like scrolling at like the description on the Spotify. And the person who had recorded it was... I need to find it. It's like somebody who was recording in protest of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
What?
So like they were like, this is blasphemous, this text, and I'm reading it so that we can all understand that it's blasphemous.
Oh, that is so interesting.
Yeah, so let me read you the description on the Spotify. It says, this is a non-biblical polytheist writing which attempts to retell the biblical flood. There is a flood narrative that I'll get to later. Their viewpoint. This is presented for a view into the hearts and minds of polytheists only. Know thy enemy.
Wow. I love that. That's so, especially because like this text is older than
the Bible.
At least, yeah, I was about to say at least Christianity and Islam, but I'm not quite sure about Judaism, like when Judaism was conceived as
to
concept.
Be fair, I think it is older than don't quote me on that, I'm not certain of the dates, but I think it might be older than even Judaism.
Yeah, this guy's passion. It's for literally, like, imagine having to, like, hating something so much, but wanting to prove why you hated it by, like, forcing yourself to read it to other people.
Literally. And then, oh no, that was a really funny...
It's kind of like you with Twilight when you did that to yourself, you know? It's like, I want to read it to prove why it's so crap.
You know what? It was actually, on reflection, now that I'm more mature, I'm like, what a banger.
Now that you're more... Only mature people read Twilight, guys.
Exactly.
You know, it is a banger, you're right.
It's what's interesting, though... is at the very end of this little intense message, it says, it is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of like when I go into like reading right-wing newspapers or something, like watching CNN news.
Yeah,
like anything.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly.
Maybe I should open my mind more to... But I know, I think I'm not gonna let this guy make me have some kind of like breakdown in the way that I think.
Absolutely not.
But no, I love that. Was he good at reading it anyway?
Mean, you can tell that they're not, that they can't pronounce any of the words, but I respect that. So that's cute.
Okay, lovely.
Oh,
anyway,
okay,
we know that it's about a guy called Gilgamesh.
Yes.
And he's 2/3 a god.
Yes.
And a third human.
Yes, I believe. I hope we can quote me on that.
Okay.
And one of his mothers is Ninsun.
Okay.
Who is a goddess.
That's such a nice name.
It is. I mean, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Ninsun. Ninsun. Okay. Ninsun. And was a Mesopotamian, goddess. Oh. Who's best known for being the mother of Gilgamesh, and the wife of the deified legendary king Lugalbanda. So basically all of these gods and kings, etc., were associated with this area of southern Mesopotamia called Uruk.
Okay.
And Gilgamesh was the king of Uruk. And he was known as this very harsh ruler at the beginning of the story. And we like enter, and he's just a harsh ruler, terrified by the people are like scared of him. And that's sort of where our story begins.
Okay, I have a question quickly.
Yes.
Were a lot of the kings around about that time supposed to be like sons of gods, or was this like specifically special with Gilgamesh?
Ooh. You know, so I can't say I know the answer to that question, but I would assume that there would be some kind of divine aspect for most of them, since, like, that's the vibes in it.
No, I see where you're coming from. But, like, you know, sometimes it's divine right, or it's, like, actual divinity, you know?
That's true.
But to be fair, I don't really care. Let's just carry on.
Do not have answers to your question.
And also, I feel like our poor, poor listeners must just be thinking, like, can we just hear the goddamn story?
Okay, so let us begin. Harsh times. And the god Anu is, like, looking at Gilgamesh, and he's like, gosh, this guy's harsh. I'm going to make him a friend. So he creates this man called Enkidu. And Enkidu is the most important aspect of this story, you might say.
Oh, besides Gilgamesh.
Yeah, I know. So Enkidu initially like lives among the animals and is just like this wild man.
That's so cute.
I know, I love that for him. but he eventually makes his way into Uruk, where Gilgamesh has like very has sort of this relationship with prophecy in the future. It's the vibes I get from the hearing guide, from the stuff I've heard so far. Like he can like sense when something is about to come or change, etc. So in the lead up to Enkidu coming, he's like, I'm feeling something's about to happen.
Oh, I love that he's so in touch with his like gut.
Yes. So Enkidu arrives, and initially him and Enkidu clash. They are not getting on. They have this massive fight, and everybody's like, fight.
Like the beginning of Merlin.
Oh my god, literally. So, there are so many parallels to Merlin now that you say it, actually.
Oh my god.
So Gilgamesh eventually wins this fight.
Okay.
But it's like chill because he's like, you know what? Literally, like Gilgamesh, like Merlin, he's like, you know what? You put up a good fight, let's be best friends. So.
Oh my gosh, this is adorable.
So then the two of them become best friends and companions. Like, they are tight. These two are the two. They are inseparable.
Oh my gosh.
And in Sumerian texts, Enkidu is known as the servant.
Oh, wow. You know what? There must be, like, fan literature on this.
Fan literature is such a fancy way of saying fanfic.
I feel like I had to give it more.
More gravitas.
More. I was considering it was like, this is a holy ancient text. Anyway.
You know, I'll look into it. I'll see if there is.
Gilgamesh fan literature.
So basically, they head off to the cedar forest, which is actually, I remember this because in the bit that I've got up to so far in my audiobook, they're going on and on about the cedar forest. Oh. But I don't really know why, and we will never know because there's not recorded surviving fragments of this bit.
Oh my god.
So they go into the cedar forest, but what transpired? Who knows?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So then after the cedar forest,
I love that you still told us that. You could have just gone on to the next bit, but you were like, they had to enter a cedar forest.
Exactly. Well, it seems a pretty pivotal point. I'm banging on about it, so what can I do?
Fair enough.
So then Gilgamesh is like, I don't know, vibing about, and this the goddess of love, and also, I'm pretty sure, war. If I remember correctly from the In Our Time podcast, is like, look, Gilgamesh, let's get married. And Gilgamesh is like, no, Tar, I'm good. I don't want to marry you because I'm in love with my best friend, Enkidu. Well, no, he doesn't actually say that. I'm implying a lot of analysis, my own analysis to this. But he rejects.
Queer theory, I love it.
Indeed. Well, to be fair, you say queer theory. Actually, it's not... he doesn't necessarily specifically reject Ishtar for Enkidu, but it's like canon within the text that Enkidu and Gilgamesh had a romantic relationship. Yeah. They like loved each other.
Aww,
so
that's so wholesome.
It's a beautiful time. Yeah. They were like tight.
Yeah.
So he rejects Ishtar's marriage proposal.
Okay.
And
as if he's allowed to reject a god like that.
Well, this is going to have many terrible repercussions.
Okay.
So Ishtar is super angry, and she sends a divine bull to destroy Gilgamesh. And then Enkidu and Gilgamesh team up and destroy the bull.
Oh, that's so cute. Let's try and relate this to like an episode of Merlin.
Gosh, they're always teaming up to kill things. It's a beautiful time. They both in the third episode of the first season, they team up to kill that monster that's in the water that's poisoning
Yes, I was thinking of that one.
Oh my god, I'm so glad we're on the same wavelength.
Amazing, excellent stuff. Okay.
So basically, in Enkidu's dream, because Enkidu also has kind of prophetic vibes, he's sleeping after they've killed the bull, and it's transpires that the Anu, who created him, and another two gods, Ea and Shamash, decide that he has to die for slaying the bull.
Why? Also, is he completely divine as well, or is he just considered mortal?
Enkidu?
Yeah.
He's mortal, he's like a man.
Damn it.
Yeah.
I'm so upset.
I know. So this is like about halfway through the story, I would say. So at this point, it's been very much sort of like coming of age, Gilgamesh learning to soften, not to bring it back to Merlin, but learning to soften around Enkidu and be a kinder person.
Yeah. Does the kingdom feel it?
I don't know, but That he seems very generous with giving people bread.
Oh, good, good.
There's a quote actually that I was gonna quote later, but I'll quote it now, where he said, and it was interesting to like know how fundamental bread was throughout everything ever. Like, yeah. Bread is so fundamental. It says, "Eat bread, O Enkidu. It is the conformity of life, of the conditions, and the fate of the land."
That is so interesting. I also have a fun bread fact as well.
Oh my gosh, exciting.
Let me just check, because I don't want to say it's part of like the wrong culture before I start saying it. Okay, so in Anglo-Saxon times, the word for Lord was Hlaethwyrd.
Right.
I think that's how you say it, I really don't know. But that basically means like a bread protector.
Uh-huh.
And then the word for lady was Hlaethdiga. Again, don't know if I've said that properly. And that meant bread maker, which is like a bit sad, but anyway, continuing. And then the word for like followers or like the people, the subjects was wife eater, which means bread eaters.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I just love that like a whole society is just based on bread.
Bread. It makes the world go round, I'm telling you.
Innit? Anyway, let's carry on with Gilgamesh.
Yeah, so Enkidu then has this dream. And in the dream, he's like fallen ill. I mean, just not even just in the dream, just like generally he falls ill. And he dreams of the house of dust that awaits him on the other side. And after that dream dies.
Oh my god.
And so the rest of the story is basically follows firstly Gilgamesh lamenting his friend and grieving his death. And they have like a state funeral. And then afterwards, basically going on this quest to understand grief and how he grapples with it.
This was not the turn I was expecting. I'm not gonna lie. I thought it was gonna literally be them two till the end, and then maybe his death at the end. But it's so interesting that that happens. I'm assuming fairly early on in the time.
Like I would say about halfway through. The text.
That they actually like are giving that time to experience like a grieving process. You know, I don't really see grieving processes being talked about for that much time.
Exactly. This is like very much like the rest of the story is centered around this.
Wow.
And not to bring it back to Merlin, but what else happens to Merlin? Oh yeah, his best friend dies.
But at the end of like season 5, when
this
the show
true.
Ends, you
this
know, we don't get to look at how Merlin like cries. We just get to see him like randomly walk across some like modern English like countryside road.
Yeah, this is where they dropped the ball. This is where they should have carried on with the canon of the Gilgamesh text.
We'll revive it.
So then this is where the flood comes in, because Gilgamesh makes this dangerous journey in search of one of the survivors of the Babylonian flood in order to learn from him how to escape death. Then the rest of that portion of the story is them recounting the tale of the massive flood and what happened.
Yeah. Why does he want to know this though? Does he want to escape death?
Yeah, it really freaked him out.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, so he was like, his denial almost, I guess, of the existence of death.
Okay.
It spurs him on initially, where he's like, oh my god, how do I escape this fate? But then he's told where he can find a plant that will renew his youth.
Okay. This is like Tangled.
Oh my gosh, literally vibes.
Stop making all these references.
And then when he gets the plant, it's seized by a serpent. And so Gilgamesh is like, sad times.
Oh, and he just lets that happen?
Yeah, I guess.
He's not
so.
Like, fight me, serpent, I'm a god.
I'm sure that there might be a fight sequence, but he is eventually unsuccessful and returns to Uruk.
Fair dues.
The epic ends with the return of... I'm not sure of the full context of this, but Gilgamesh has, like, a loss of a couple of objects, a puku and a miku, which translate as a drum and a drumstick, and they were given to him by Ishtar, the woman he rejected the marriage proposal from.
Yeah.
And the epic ends with the return of the spirit of Enkidu, who promised to recover the objects and then was like, and also the underworld is a really bad place.
Oh my god! What? Oh my gosh! Wow! Why? What did he say about the underworld? Was he like, everyone's just burning in this hellhole?
That's such a good question.
Did we get to see Gilgamesh's reaction? Like, this totally needs, like, a part two.
You know what? I will, once I've read it,
it needs a sequel.
Well, I'll do a follow-up in another episode.
Surely, even if we don't have, like, a sequel from the original text, like, oh my god, we need, someone out there must have written a sequel to this.
I should hope. So, Gilgamesh is known for its, like, existential themes of, like, oh my god, death, what the hell. And so apparently that really appealed to German authors in the years following World War II.
Oh, so interesting.
Yeah, and so in 1947, a German novelist, Hermann Cassack, wrote a novel, Die Stadt hinter dem Strom. Let's all move on.
Don't look at that.
And he adapted elements of the epic into a metaphor for the aftermath of the destruction of World War II in Germany.
Oh wow, that's incredible.
And portrays the bombed out city of Hamburg as resembling the frightening underworld seen by Enkidu in his dreams.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that there must have been a quite horrifying description of the underworld from Enkidu to inspire literature based on it.
Gosh, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, especially the idea of just being obviously inspired by events that are happening in your time and how to, like, interpret ancient literature from what you've experienced yourself. I wonder if, like, before that as well, we do have any literature that's very much like that from maybe the medieval time, of, like, people trying to relate Gilgamesh to, like, the world that they're living in and everything else like that. That would be so interesting.
That's true.
Or even the Regency era. I'm not asking for people to go too far back in time. That's super cool.
Yeah. So that is the story of Gilgamesh. And yeah, as you say, it does have lots of pertinent themes to now. Like, just reading here, that it also became a staple in queer literature because of Gilgamesh and Enkidu.
Oh my god. I was about to say, for your birthday party, should we dress up as Gilgamesh?
Oh my gosh, so obscure, but I'm here for it. I don't even know what they wear, but sure.
Just wear Gilgamesh across your forehead. It's all good.
And, you know, it's been, like, a really big, at least for me, when I first heard about it, I was like, you know, this proves that, like, queer relationships are as old as time itself. Yeah. Like, they're literally in it's a huge feature in one of the oldest texts we know of.
Yeah.
So, there we are.
There you go.
And, yeah, and interestingly, in more recent years, it's even been seen through an environmentalist lens, with Enkidu's death symbolising man's separation from nature.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
So there's a lot to grapple with.
Wait one minute. What about... you know what? I don't think you're going to give me the answer. Does it matter?
No, ask it anyway.
I was going to say, like, because Enkidu, like, starts off being with the animals and stuff and being really happy in nature, and then he, like, goes to, like, the city.
Mm.
And so wouldn't that bit kind of be, like, man's separation from nature? Like, why is it his death, you know?
Well, maybe I can see how maybe his whole life symbolises that. You're right, I have no answers. But it's an interesting thought to have that, like, you could almost argue Enkidu's entire life
represents
like what happens, like he separates from nature and gains a lot from it, like his relationship with Gilgamesh, but then also suffers from it because it is eventually that that leads to his doom.
Yeah, and like obviously, despite having gone into the city, Enkidu still remembers like his past with the animals, with nature, whatever. Mm-hmm. And maybe the idea is that like once he dies, that knowledge or that experience dies with him, and like there's no one else to pass it on to, or like people just like forget what it means to be at one with nature, or like I don't know, maybe that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because I do think about it every now and then. I'm just like, if I were to just like walk along a forest and try and like forage food to survive, like so many people have been doing for years, I would be dead. Would be so dead. Like I'd pick the wrong mushroom, I'd pick the wrong berry. Like it's just incredible.
Yeah, and back in the day it was just instinct and knowledge, like in a deep Like, you'd just grow up with that knowledge.
Yeah.
It'd be second... yeah, it would...
Anyway, I bought some foraging books, so I think I'm going to be okay.
Yeah,
I'm prepared for the apocalypse.
You will walk out that book and be like, I am ready to do this.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, no, thank you for that. That was really interesting. I feel really inspired.
I was just sort of looking up some of the best quotes from it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's quite interesting reading these quotes without... any context. But there's I believe a quote from when Enkidu first is introduced to the life in the city, and about him adapting from nature to the city. And the quote says, "Milk of the cattle he drank, food they placed before him. He broke bread, gazing and looking, but Enkidu understood not bread to eat, beer to drink. He had not been taught."
Oh wow.
Yeah.
I just feel really inspired to read this now because, like, the little snippets, like, the little bits that we do have knowledge of, like, I just feel obviously I'm left asking more questions that can't be answered.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
It also just sounds like it's very nicely written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or translated. I mean, definitely translated. Well done, translator.
Yeah. It's like. Really, it sounds like just a really, and I think it's just really, it's just profound, you know? It explores.
Yeah.
It is, because it explores, like.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. I felt like your energy draining, like, instantly in the moment, and then you said profound, and it, like, you lit up again.
Because it's just exploring, so I think it's just really interesting how that humans, like, it doesn't matter how much time has passed, how much technology has developed in these thousands of years, how much capital, like, the different political systems we have changed and come and gone and everything, there are just some core enduring things that connect every single human in, like, history to do with love and grief and, like, core human emotions.
Yeah.
And that's so powerful that from the beginning of readable texts is, like, things that people want to write about.
Yeah, definitely. It's incredible as well because obviously, like, with emotions, we're still trying to figure them out, like, decades, millennia later. And it's just ridiculous. Like, sometimes I'm like, wow, humans are so stupid. Like, our emotional capabilities, like, why haven't we got a hold of our emotions? But it's also kind of beautiful because then we get texts like this coming out, like, literally just, like, if we wanted to every single year because everyone's trying to figure them out in their own ways. And I'm okay with our stupidity.
That's so true. So, yeah.
No, thank you. I think that was a really good first episode. You did a good job.
Thank you. I'm so impressed with myself. What can I say?
I'll reward you with some good stir fry for lunch.
Excellent.
But yeah, that was great. That I don't know what the next episode is going to be, but hopefully it will be as lit as this one.
I'm sure it shall be. I'm very excited for this season.
Yeah,
to,
it was
like,
really
discover
nice.
New stuff.
Yeah, and already I feel like the tone for this season has been set quite nicely in that, I mean, besides me asking many questions throughout, it really felt like just this really nice story, like, just settling down and just, like, being able to, like, just really, like, even more so than other seasons, like, passively take in, like, information. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I know that there's always the one person who's presenting and the other person who's listening.
Yeah.
But, like, this time it was just, like, cute bedtime story vibes.
Exactly. I think, yeah, we can, I'm excited to hear the stories. That yes. will be, like, the core of the episode.
Indeed. Anyway, this has been Audacious Aunties.
And we'll see you next time, whenever that is.
Yep. Have a lovely rest of your day, a week, / maybe month, until we get out the next episode.
Bye. No,
we'll be before then. Okay, bye.
Bye.
This audio was brought to you by Manveer Dobb and Asya Iftikhar.
We don't know much, to say the least.
But if you would like to share your thoughts, knowledge, criticisms, fan mail,
then pop us an email at audaciousaunties@gmail.com.